headlines, G7 leaders promise to strengthen Ukraine's air defense amid continued Russian airstrikes. The U.S., South Korea, and Japan have pledged to keep all options open against North Korea, including counterstrikes. And in a few weeks' time, Venezuela will reopen its border with Colombia. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisun Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. A group of seven major economies vowed to keep supporting Ukraine by pumping up more weapons to the country. The G7 members say they will shore up Ukraine's air defenses and continue to help Kiev meet its urgent requirements for military equipment. The bloc includes Britain and the U.S. that have been the biggest providers of military aid to Ukraine since the start of a war with Russia in February. The G7 made a pledge after Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky appealed for more military assistance to counter Russia.
Ukraine needs modern tanks. I ask you to make this defensive weapon to us. It is possible to do it now. Ukraine needs stable supportive artillery with howitzers and rockets in order to prevent escalation from the Russian side. We need more response artillery and long-range rockets. The more effective we are with these weapons, the shorter the Russian aggression will be.
Zelensky also called on G7 to provide Ukraine with an additional 2 billion cubic meters of natural gas to help the country cope with energy shortages. This comes as Ukrainians are struggling to keep warm during winter and face power cuts amid Russian airstrikes on critical infrastructure. Earlier, our correspondent in Moscow, Johnny Mueller, joined us with his take on the West's military assistance to Ukraine.
NATO countries seem reticent to give Ukraine some of their most advanced weaponry. Why is that? First of all, they're concerned that some of this technology may well fall into the Russians' hands. Of course, there was the famous incident some years ago when the Iranians shot down an American drone and then reversed engineered it. Drones, of course, very important in this conflict, and the Americans not giving their most advanced drones, which could have a huge effect on the battlefield, to the Ukrainians for this very reason. There's also a fear that of whether the most advanced NATO anti-air defense, for example, would be able to shoot down the most advanced Russian missiles. Russia has some of the most advanced hypersonic missiles in the world. And so there's questions about just how effective even the most advanced NATO air defense would be against Russian missiles. And of course, it's not a good look trying to sell these weapons around the world when on a live conflict zone, you're seeing they're not maybe as successful as you would hope. But at the moment, Ukraine also asking NATO for more long-range missiles, and that would be a major escalation from NATO if they were to do that. If, for example, Ukraine was able to fire a missile at Moscow, I spoke to a Russian government official yesterday who warned that Russia has a huge military capability they haven't used yet.
More news from Ukraine. The country says the world should reconsider the issue of nuclear security amid what Kiev calls Russian attacks against Europe's largest nuclear power plant.
It changed everything. I mean, and I think that that's a very important issue, that all the world should rethink what is nuclear safety now and how we could respond. We just cannot look at this, what is happening, and say, yes, it's bad, or look what is happening. So we need to respond to this. And the response could be, first, we should do something with the Russians, that's for sure. I mean, because that's, they break everything that was built before.
You know, that's a question, you know, that's a question.
The minister also warned that Russian missiles with a range of 2,000 kilometers are a threat, as they could reach any nuclear reactor in Europe. Ukraine accuses Russia of targeting Zaporizhzhia power plant, which has been under the control of the Russian forces since March. Kiev says the site has been cut off Ukraine's energy grid several times due to Russian shelling. The Kremlin has pushed back against the allegations. It says that Ukraine has committed nuclear terrorism by launching attacks on the nuclear plant. The UN nuclear watchdog has also raised alarm over the safety of the plant. Staying with Europe, thousands of rail workers will go on strike across the UK later on Tuesday amid a backlash over economic pressure across different sectors. Britain's largest rail union, RMT, has called the industrial action. The strikers are expected to organize picket lines at major train stations. The action is expected to trigger massive transport disruption during the Christmas travel peak. Britain has been witnessing back-to-back strikes over the past months. Those include a work stoppage by postal workers and border officers. Britain is also facing a rising inflation and surging energy prices that came on the heels of Western sanctions on Russia over the war in Ukraine. The U.S., Japan, and South Korea are going to impose more sanctions on North Korea to counter what they call Pyongyang's nuclear threat.
Based on the robust ROK-U.S. alliance and the trilateral security cooperation, we will strengthen our deterrence against North Korea's nuclear and missile threat. We will coordinate sanctions and close gaps in the international sanctions regime.
The official also accused Pyongyang of becoming more aggressive and blatant in its threats. He made the comments in a meeting with his U.S. and Japanese counterparts in Jakarta. The U.S. representative also described North Korea's behavior as one of the most serious security challenges to the region and beyond. Meanwhile, the Japanese envoy said the trio would examine all options, including counterstrike capabilities. The sanctions follow the test of an intercontinental ballistic missile by North Korea last month. Pyongyang has fired over 60 missiles, including 8 ICBMs, this year in response to U.S. hostilities. North says that its missile program is for self-defense. Venezuela says it will fully reopen its land border with Colombia within weeks after a thaw in ties between the two neighbors.
I can announce that we will be completely opening the entire western border of Venezuela with Colombia for the passage of vehicles.
Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, underlined that Caracas is committed to the pledges that it made during the recent talks with Bogota. The border between the two countries partially reopened in October after 7 years of closure. Diplomatic relations between the two countries broke off in 2019 after former Colombian government questioned Maduro's election victory. Colombia's new president, Gustavo Petro, however, has taken steps to mend ties with Venezuela since taking office in June. The two neighbors formally re-established diplomatic relations in August. The situation remains tense in Peru, where ousted President Pedro Castillo has slammed his successor as a usurper. In a handwritten letter released on Twitter from prison, Castillo said that he had been kidnapped and humiliated. Parliament installed Dina Boluarte as a president after Castillo attempted to dissolve the Congress. He was subsequently impeached and arrested. Boluarte, who was the former vice president for Castillo, has vowed to hold elections planned for 2026, 2 years early, in an attempt to ease the deadly weekend protest. Hundreds of protesters have now blocked the airport runway in Peru's second largest city. The protesters reject the installment of Boluarte and they are calling for Castillo's release. So far, 7 people have been killed and many more injured in the unrest. Boluarte has declared a state of emergency in volatile areas. The resistance movement Hamas says Palestinians will never allow Israel to implement its malicious schemes for Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque in particular. The head of Hamas's political bureau says the issue of Al-Quds will remain a top priority for the movement and Palestinian people everywhere. Ismail Haniyeh was speaking on the occasion of Hamas's 35th anniversary. The top Hamas official stressed that the movement has a clear and unwavering strategy towards the Palestinian cause and the struggle against the Israeli settler and colonial project. He said Hamas has long been committed to the unity of Palestinian people at home and abroad in the face of Israeli occupation and its schemes. Haniyeh also explained that Hamas has adopted a strategy of establishing balanced ties with all Arab Muslim nations with a focus on the Palestinian cause. Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent in Gaza, is with us right now. Ashraf, it is the 35th anniversary of Hamas. Tell us more about this resistance movement, why it was created, and tell us more about the 35-year record of this movement.
Well, so the official date for Hamas's anniversary is actually tomorrow, 14th of December. 1987, this is when the movement was established, and just a few days before the mass rallies that will be held in Gaza, Hamas's political bureau chief, Ismail Haniyeh, gave a televised speech talking about the that Hamas and the Palestinian people and the resistance factions will not allow the Israeli regime to go ahead with its schemes, especially against Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Haniyeh is referring to the almost daily desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque and also the constant Judaization of the holy city of Al-Quds by Israeli settlers. Haniyeh talked about during his speech about unity among the Palestinian people, and also Hamas' strategy in dealing with Arab and Islamic nations in a balanced way, focusing on the Palestinian issue. Regarding Hamas, as I said, established 35 years ago during the first Palestinian Intifada, or popular uprising against the Israeli occupation. Year after year, Hamas gained popularity within Palestine and also within and among Palestinians abroad, and due to its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime and its refusal to recognize the Israeli regime as well. In 2006, Hamas overwhelmingly won the Palestinian legislative elections, and soon after that, it was boycotted by the West, and also most countries in the Western Hemisphere, they refused to recognize Hamas's when during that that election. And a year after it was elected, Israel imposed a hermetic siege on Gaza, trying to weaken Hamas, and also waged multiple wars and aggressions on the Gaza Strip to try to weaken Hamas and to try to weaken its military wing, the Izzin al-Qassam brigades. But year after year, Hamas continues to gain popularity among Palestinians, despite all these attempts by Israel and the West to undermine it.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, joining us live from Gaza City. Moving on, the European Union has imposed fresh sanctions on Iran over its response to the recent riots in the country and alleged drone deliveries to Russia. 20 individuals and one entity were sanctioned over claims of human rights abuses, and four more people and four entities were also blacklisted over the issue of drones. Those targeted include the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, its director, and the chief commander of the army. Sanctions include asset freezes and travel bans from to the EU. Western countries accuse Iran of cracking down on protesters, but Iran says it is rightfully stamping out foreign-backed riots. On Monday, And in response to earlier bans, Tehran imposed sanctions on 17 individuals and entities in Britain, as well as 15 others in the European Union. They were blacklisted for supporting terrorist groups inciting terrorism, violence, and hatred in Iran. Iran has also repeatedly denied Western allegations of providing drones to Russia for the war in Ukraine. Iran has held an exhibition of domestically made machinery and equipment dubbed Made in Iran. The expo seeks to support domestic producers amid Western sanctions that have prevented Iranian industries from accessing foreign technologies. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Every product showcased here carries one same tag, Made in Iran, which is also the title of this exhibition. It's the 10th edition of the annual tech event that brings Iranian local producers under one roof in Tehran to promote their products in a range of industries, from oil and petrochemical sectors to electricity, agriculture, and health.
An equipment, a quadcopter. To look for example, people or survivor under the rubble, so also we can save them.
We have showcased our 3D printer today. 3D printing can manufacture parts within hours, which speeds up the prototyping process. This allows for each stage to complete faster.
I work in Saudi Foundation. We are trying to develop a Persian language through softwares, and we're trying to make people know about Iran, the truth about Iran.
The expo is a hot marketplace for local tech products, as it gives a chance to manufacturers to trade their products here. In fact, it's a win-win deal for both customers and producers, because any product is sold with as much as 50% discount, funded by Iran's Vice Presidency for Science and Technology, with the aim of supporting domestic production.
Our equipment are considered inventions, so they are not well known. Now, this expo shines a light on our products and has so far helped us find many customers.
Since the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reimposition of sanctions on Iran in 2018, Tehran has doubled down on its efforts to wean its economy off the ups and downs of politics. While the Iranian government still pursues diplomatic channels with the West, it capitalizes more on domestic production, as it believes this will shield the economy against foreign pressures.
Local brands here say the United States measures have given domestic production a boost in Iran. As they say, the government has made a strategic shift toward an economy that's driven by Made in Iran products. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we discussed the very short period of Rajoy's presidency, which ended in his martyrdom by MKO terrorists. Today we are going to talk about the simple life of Imam Khomeini, despite being the leader of the Islamic Ummah. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini's simple way of living was not limited to the period of his studies at the seminary and his struggles against the despotic Pahlavi regime. Rather, the Imam and his family lived a very simple life throughout his leadership as the father of the Islamic Revolution and the founder of the Islamic Republic system. He would never allow his family to do anything which would resemble a luxurious life. Although Imam Khomeini was excessively busy with major policies of the Islamic system and the Islamic Ummah, he was never heedless of the family expenses and would always remind family members on extravagance. Once, he even opposed to adding a new lamp to increase the light of the yard. Although the Imam knew his wife well, he would sometimes remind her of observing simplicity. Imam Khomeini was very careful, even while performing ritual ablution. In other words, he used to turn off the tap and then turn it on for each part of the ablution. It has been narrated that when he drank water, he would not pour away the additional water and he would put a piece of paper on the glass to drink it later on. As a disciple of Imam Ali's school, Imam Khomeini used to sharpen his pencil and write lines near to each other to avoid extravagance. Once he said, "Many may think that material welfare and having money in banks or owning lands and such things will bring man happiness. This is a mistake that some make. When we evaluate the happiness of human beings, we realize that the happy were those who were in slums. Those who are in palaces are not happy." During the eight-year imposed war and the likely terrorist attacks, the lives of Imam Khomeini and his near ones were at serious risk. Yet the Imam never agreed with taking special measures to safeguard his life and increase his security. As Saddam's army started air raids against Iran's cities, Tehran was targeted with missiles. Saddam had even thought of missile attack on Jamaran to kill Imam Khomeini. In those conditions, the Imam was asked to go to a shelter, which he never accepted. He would say, "Do all people have a shelter or are able to go to a shelter at the time of the enemy's air attack?" The Imam's wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, would always stay with him at the same room, which was mainly made of wood. One day, a cement makeshift shelter was brought to be set up for Imam Khomeini and his family. He asked about the structure, and when he was answered that the structure had been brought for shelter, he told his son, Ahmad Agha, angrily, "Do all people have a shelter so that we too may have one? Ahmad, by God, I don't consider an iota of difference between my life and the life of that guard who is walking in the alley. If they have a shelter, we should have one too. Tell them, take back all this." As it was said, Imam Khomeini would seriously refrain from luxurious life and would prevent others against trappings. His daughter, Ms. Farideh Mostafavi, says the rocks of the exterior of Imam's house were incomplete. I told him to let us fill the empty part. He said, there is a rock in the interior. I told him that they are gilim and are not good for the exterior. He said, is this the house of a chancellor? It is also famous that when the Imam was asked to let the eroded bricks of the steps be changed, he simply said, tell the mason to turn over the eroded bricks and put them in their place. Imam Khomeini had also been asked to let the plaster of the room be renewed, which he reacted and said, you are building a palace for me. I am not a palace dweller. Do not do this. If you want to decorate here, stop it till I am alive. Dear listeners, these were few examples of the simple life of a man who overthrew the despotic Pahlavi regime and brought the global arrogance symbolized by the U.S. to its knees.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S.-backed Saudi-led war in Yemen continues to take its toll on the civilian population, especially children. According to the U.N., more than 11,000 children are known to have been killed or maimed, a toll likely to be far higher, while hundreds of thousands more remain at risk of death from preventable diseases or starvation. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how can the U.S. and EU support and back the Saudi regime when civilian lives, especially children, are being lost, and why the international community as a whole has fallen way short when it comes to Yemen. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah McNair joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Fra Hughes, journalist, activist, and director at the Palestine Aid, joins us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Fra Hughes, I'll start with you, and I want to zoom in on the position that you have in your title as an activist when you hear about the alarming stats, which I'm just going to round it up. I don't want to just keep hashing it out throughout the program. 11,000 children to have been killed or maimed. Thousands have lost their lives, obviously. Hundreds of thousands remain at risk of death from the key word preventable diseases or starvation. And then you have about 2.2 million Yemeni children acutely malnourished, one quarter of them under the age of five. And then most at risk of cholera, measles, and other vaccines. Your reaction to that?
I th-
think they're very sobering statistics, and I think that the very important thing about statistics are, apart from the fact that they're factually accurate, although as you've stated, they could be a lot higher than has been recorded, I think every statistic represents a person, be it a child, a father, a brother, a sister, a mother, an auntie or an uncle. Every preventable death, every death that has occurred due to Saudi Arabia's disgraceful kind of attack and punitive punishment of the people of Yemen. Behind every statistic, there is a human being, there is a wider family, there is a community and wider society. When you look at how many people have died, how many people are facing hunger, the absolute kind of travesty and tragedy that is existing and how people are forced to live every day, it's all preventable. It could all stop tomorrow. It's not just a matter of political will. It's a matter of humanitarian desire by the people involved to end this kind of horror show that's being inflicted upon the people of Yemen. I mean, it just struck me earlier before you went on air, I was thinking, you know, is this all down to one man? Is this one person's ego? Is this Mohammed bin Salman? Is it all down to him? I know he's backed by America. I know he's backed by Britain. I know he's backed by Israel. I know he has his own kind of twisted political ideology that has him involved in the war on Yemen. But I do wonder if he was not in charge. I also believe possibly before 2015. I don't know if he was the minister for the army and stuff in Riyadh, but it seems to be since he took over the reins of power in Riyadh that this has all come about. So
sure.
It's tragic and it's sad and it's eminently preventable.
Well, the key word, as you mentioned or repeated my stance on this, preventable is what is the focus in my next question to you, Elijah Magnier, also, because Ansarullah has come out and said that, well, they have been looted by over $13 billion worth of their oil wealth over the past 5 years. This is money, obviously, that could have been spent in terms of the revenues they generated that's been stolen on their population, on their local population. And that's kind of sad. Why is it that this looting, which continues to this day, a lot of it to have been attributed to the UAE, still continues, even though, of course, Ansarullah is trying to find a way to stop that?
Well, actually, no war has been more deadly over the last 8 years than the Saudi-US Western war on Yemen. The theft of the Yemeni oil falls into the same policy of the West to deprive the Yemeni from their natural resources, as they are doing with Syria, and is to starve further the Yemeni population, because it is not enough to see more than half of the population starving. 23 million in Yemen are suffering because of the war, and the double standard of the West is so obvious that we have people lecturing us about what's happening in Ukraine and what Russia is doing in Ukraine and how we need to feel in support of the Ukrainian, and the war has been going on only for the last 8 to 10 months. So we have 8 years almost of massacring, mainly children under the age of 5, half a million, as you rightly said, and 2.2 million children malnourished. All that is really going just invisible to mainstream media, to the Saudi, to the Emiratis, to the Americans, to the Europeans, who pretend to be supportive of the humanitarian cause of the world. So all that is a pure double standard on how we deal with the poorest country in the Middle East. But when it comes to a country in the European continent, so we change all our values suddenly. And stealing the revenue of Yemen, preventing Sana'a from having its share, from having the salary of the employers, from allowing the airport to function properly, from allowing the harbor to receive all the goods that are needed in Yemen. This is a really genocide that's happening under our eyes, and we feel completely numbed about it because This is what the West wants us to avoid and not to look at for the last 8 years.
Sure. Well, when we want to take a look at a response to this, Frahi, is in terms of trying to figure out how we can help, we cumulatively, as in the notion of us, the world, altogether, we need to, because we keep asking, what about the international community? Why is it not doing enough? This so-called international community has to go through, if it wants to do something on a large scale, through organizations like the UN. Well, the UN doesn't even have enough money to fulfill its budget. The news came out last week, and we've heard that scenario before. Other organizations cannot live up to the monumental task of trying to provide for all these people. But there is one source that can do that. That source, based on the revenues for one day, generates $700 million in profits every single day. And that's Saudi Arabia's Aramco. Just for one day, and that money, that could help solve the problem. I don't know to what degree, but to a large degree, of what's happening in Yemen. What does that say when Saudi Arabia doesn't want to give up profits for one day to help that situation?
It maybe proves that money is more important than human life, that the value they place on money is more important than the value that they place on human life. I mean, when we witness kind of what's happening in Yemen, again, you know, I see parallels with Gaza. Gaza's under siege by air, by land, and by sea, by the Zionist entity. It figures out how many calories the people can get by on per day. It prevents children moving from Gaza to the West Bank or indeed Israel in order to receive medical treatment. It bans all kinds of building supplies, medical supplies, even food supplies, fuel supplies from reaching Gaza. So we have exactly the same situation in Yemen. And if you look at what's happening in Gaza, and you look at how the Zionist entity is stealing the resources of the Palestinian people in the gas and oil fields that are off the Gazan coast, we witness exactly the same thing in Yemen. A lot of wars are about political control. They are also about land acquisition and expansionism for the countries involved. But the bottom line has always been money, and it is about money. And so long as the UAE and Saudi Arabia and others continue to steal the oil from the ports in Yemen, then I think this will continue because there is simply money to be made. If you talk about the hypocrisy of the West, we could talk about that forever and a day. I remember in, I think it was 1985, don't quote me in the year, when they did the big band aid concerts and they raised millions upon millions for the starving and the dying in Africa. I see no band aid concert for Yemen. I look at my Facebook feed, all I see are people cheering England leaving the World Cup. All I see is people cheering Morocco, possibly having a huge upset over France. Yemen is not even on my timeline. It's not even on my friends list of things that people are genuinely concerned about.
Sure.
Because there is international coverage, and the West is quite happy to allow millions of people to starve and die while it suits their political purposes to do so.
Indeed. Well, you know what? You mentioned a good point there, that it's not ranking. As our guest there said, Elijah Magnier, Frahi was mentioning the fact that it's not ranking on top of the list, whether it's the news, whether it's celebrities maybe, or people who have something to say from politics and what have you. But it's, I want to have your elaboration on this money that's generated by Saudi Arabia, because it's quite a big figure, $700 million a day. You know, instead of funding the Saudi channel to encourage incitement and a revolution inside the Islamic Republic, of which they go after every second of the day, perhaps that money, not perhaps, but that money, I'm sure, if you agree, can help the starving people in Yemen and prevent some of the people dying there. The fact that it's not doing that, nor is it, I'm sure, being pressured by its allies to do that, like the U.S., what does that say about the regime there in Riyadh?
Well, the regime in Saudi Arabia, because it says, since Mohammed bin Salman said it overtly, that he wants to transport the battle in Iran itself, that was an obvious declaration that he is also behind all the rioters and all the attempts to change, the failed attempt to change the regime in Iran. And that's something that the U.S. support, and then they claim they have humanitarian day on the 10th of this month by saying, on the 10th of December, by saying that this is what we are celebrating. So all the money are good as long as they are invested in curbing the population and regimes who are not obedient to the U.S. Directives and policy. That is okay. They can invest as much money as they want. They can even direct all the resources of the media to concentrate on something false and promoting incorrect narrative just to topple the regime and create coup d'etat under the name of democratic colored revolution. For that, they can invest a lot of money. But to invest money in reconstructing Yemen, that is not possible. To invest money in buying weapons to Ukraine to continue watching how the Ukrainians are killed with the Russian, that is possible. So from one day to another, America is investing $50 million in one day sending to Ukraine. So far, $66 billion to build Ukraine, reconstruct Ukraine with arsenal and weapons, but not a penny invested in Yemen, and not even the same resources that come out of Yemen. And here I allude to the Yemeni oil that is stolen because the West is in need of oil and they are taking the Yemeni and the Syrian oil. And this is should, in theory, create an outrage of all those who pretend to support the humanitarian cause around the globe. But because it is Yemen, because as your guest rightly said, it's Palestine, because it is unrest in Iran, all there is a lot of investment to support the Israelis, to support the unrest in Iran, and support the terrorists that are crossing Iraq to do such an act, and inside Iran to do act of terrorism. So that for that, they have money to invest, but not in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to expand a little bit about the regional security that involves Yemen with not a new actor, but a new energy resurfacing in a different way. We're going to get to that in a minute. I'll explain what I mean by that. But Fra Hughes, the narrative is something that needs to also have some new definitions to it. Not new definitions, but to have the general public be informed of the way this narrative is being played out when it gets covered in the news, which is a false one. And that is the way, for example, the way that the U.S. sees Yemen and Western media in turn, where they say Yemen's internationally recognized governments. Well, this internationally recognized governments, I'm not too sure which international part of it is recognizing the government that they're talking about, because the one inside of Yemen, backed by millions of these Yemenis, is what we see when we do have coverage of that. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, would pour out on the streets and support Abdelmalek al-Houthi or support the Ansarullah movement. I mean, there's obviously a huge disconnect there. Or when they talk about a Saudi-led military coalition, what coalition? The last time we checked, it's only Saudi Arabia and the UAE, unless you want to count the outside factors like the ones that provide military assistance like the U.S. or maybe some EU countries. So shouldn't the narrative also be something that should be covered here?
You see, the first, I mean, what is it to say the first casualty of war is truth? That's what we're talking about here. We are not hearing the truth. We are hearing the propaganda from the Western imperialist elite. A lot of the coverage in the West is obviously for Western audiences. If I turn on the UK television news, which I try my best not to, I will have my head and my emotions and everything twisted and turned upside down with the emotional, emotive propaganda that they use when it comes to Ukraine, when it comes to Palestine, and it comes to other conflicts throughout the world. So it's important that the real truth and the real narrative gets as wide an audience as possible. But when you have the censorship against Press TV, which we've recently seen with the Euro satellite channels, and I believe now RT, which has been banned in most of Europe and North America, Canada, and other countries, is now, I don't know, 20 or 30 countries within the old Soviet sphere of influence that have banned all the RT channels. So we're witnessing a huge propaganda war where if you're only told one side of any narrative, you have no counterbalance and you have no way to view the prism of the information that you're being given in its totality. So the propaganda war, when we had We talk about the thousands and hundreds of thousands of dead innocent civilians in Yemen. 600,000 Iraqi children died, and Madeleine Albright said she thought that the price was worth it. 600,000 babies.
Mm-hmm.
And she said the price was worth it. This is, it's not double standards. It's not hypocrisy. It is actually the kind of state, you use the word narrative, it's the state narrative being used by the capitalist elite in all these Western countries. We talk about Western society, we talk about Western media, we talk about mainstream media, we talk about, you know, the civilized West. It makes up less than 20% of the population of the world. It has an inordinate amount of money, finance, power, and influence. It's trying to hold on to all that by whatever means necessary. It's impoverishing, the West is impoverishing its own citizens in order to keep the rich and the elite in their positions of power and influence. And it has always robbed, stolen, and occupied, and raped the global South, and it's continuing to do so. So nothing's changed from the Middle Ages, and the narrative that we are being told by the mainstream media in the West is a total fabrication and a lie.
Okay. Well, let me now get to what I spoke about Elijah Magnier, and that was a not-so-new face, but a country that perhaps has a new footing in the region, and this is based... And I'd like to get your reaction on based on the visit and the lavish and extravagant, I should say, reception that Saudi Arabia had of the Chinese President Xi Jinping. Now, the summit of the Persian Gulf countries of the GCC came out with some points. One of them was that China supports Yemen's safeguarding sovereignty, independence, unity, and territorial integrity, and support parties in Yemen in settling issues through political means. Do you see any way that Xi Jinping can play a role, given the context of how it had all these multi-billion-dollar deals with Saudi Arabia and how it's going to be a provider or it's going to be a buyer? Not that it wasn't before, but now it's cemented that it's going to be probably the number one buyer of Saudi oil, amongst other business deals, that it couldn't play a role in settling this issue politically. Since the positive part about this that I can see is that it doesn't involve the U.S.
I think China is holding the stick in the middle. It is flirting with the Middle Eastern countries by supporting the unity and integrity of Yemen, also supporting a Palestinian state, and it supports the integrity of Syria. So all these slogan and big titles are part of the general policy that China is carrying out just to say, I stay on the equal distance of all the countries in the Middle East, but also around the world as well. China is not made to be a confrontational country or a belligerent and doesn't have intention to start a war or to even confront the Saudi or confront the U.S. Now, we have seen how the Saudis are taking advantage of China to send a message to the U.S. by signing a deal of $30 billion, just to say that I have other options. But it doesn't mean China is going to start working and be really active in support of the unity of Yemen and in support of a Palestinian state. The message that China is sending is China offering a model where all the countries in Asia need to be prosper and to develop, because it's important to have its plan to have all the harbor, the railway infrastructure built in every single country in the region, not only in Asia, but also to link Asia, Africa, and Europe, because China is offering a model that the U.S. is afraid of, because the U.S. went into Asia and created war, killed millions of people, and destroyed the economy of several countries. And the country that doesn't submit imposed sanctions like Iran, like Syria, like Lebanon, because they refused the U.S. policy. So China is not going to challenge the U.S. because China doesn't want to be under more sanctions than there are already 330 sanctions imposed on China. So it wants to keep the Americans away from its shore. It wants the Americans not to support Taiwan, and it doesn't want to interfere in Yemen by sending humanitarian support or reconstructing. It will not be allowed to go to Yemen to do so. China tried to do the same in Lebanon and was not allowed, and try also in Syria and wasn't not allowed, and try in Iraq, and it cost the resignation of the Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi, who was removed in the street by the pro-US. So I don't think China is going to carry out any particular role in supporting Yemen or in supporting Palestine or in challenging the US hegemony in the Middle East, in Asia, or anywhere else. I think the Americans are very aggressive now because they are challenged in Russia. They are challenged in Europe. Their policy is not going to hold the ground. Here in Brussels, we have the European officials who disagree on everything domestic, and they don't know what to do because of the lack of energy. So the whole world is really unstable today.
I have 30 seconds to give to you only, Farah Hughes. Iran has called for the formation of an inclusive government, the Iranian foreign minister adding that we believe that it's necessary to form this government where all Yemeni parties participate. There has been a truce that was no longer in effect now for, I think, a couple months, even though the truce has still lasted. There haven't been major attacks happening on a continual basis. How can the momentum towards a political solution, with the idea of Iran not being a bad one from what it sounds, to be enacted?
Well, all war ends in compromise, dialogue, and cessation of the violence. And the only way perhaps for that to happen going forward is to allow a national coalition unity government to be formed where all players have a stake at the table on behalf of their constituents and hopefully be elected and have a mandate and go forward together as one unified country. Tackling the ills that have befallen.
Sorry about that. We're just fresh out of time. Farah Hughes, journalist, activist, and director of the Palestine Aid Belfast. And Elijah Manier, thank you for your contribution, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapwe, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Noor Muhammad Pur. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. My pleasure.
Okay, Shaykh. There are two specific Quranic terms, sawab and aqab. We can say roughly it can be translated as sawab as a kind of reward which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives you because of your good deeds in this world. And aqab is a kind of chastisement because of your bad deeds in the other world. Now, the howness of counting these rewards and chastisement, and we can say the mechanism of attributing sawab and aqab to your deeds in this world is a matter of question for so many people. How does it work? This is the main question.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I need to emphasize again on the importance of the Day of Judgment. In the verse of Noble Quran, we have a lot of name and titles for the Day of Judgment. For example, Yawm al-Qiyamah, Yawm al-Hisab, Yawm al-Hasra, the Day of Regret, the Day of Reckoning, the Day of Resurrection, the Day of Judgment. You know that many verses of Noble Quran talking and dealing with the concept of the Day of Judgment. So it is that you see how important these verses are. Maybe one-third of, or more than one-third of the verses of Noble Quran deal with the concept of the Day of Judgment.
Yes.
But unfortunately, many people are ignorant. They do not pay attention to the Day of Judgment. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to make it important for people to understand that the life in this material life is like kind of playing lahwun wa la'ib.
Okay.
And actually, you should get ready for the real life, which is a Day of Judgment, and actually to have the prosperity of both this life and the Day of Judgment. So, about the reckoning in the Day of Judgment, actually Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will do that. Inna Allaha sari'ul hisab.
Okay.
Very fastly Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have this kind of reckoning of all mankind, all human beings. Maybe without any time, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will do that.
Yes.
So, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is all-powerful, almighty, you know.
Yes.
He would do that very quickly. So, it does not have any complexity for him. It is not hard for him to have this kind of, you know, reckoning for all people.
That's right.
So, I just want to mention this point that we should not compare the reckoning system with the what we do in this material life.
For example, it is not like the book of numbers, for example, in a bank system or in the markets or a stock market, that, for example, you do this, so now these numbers are given to you or something like that. That's right. So according to Allama Tabatabai, which is talking about this, we can say, Kitab al-Mahfuz, you know, which is the kept, we can say, records of your deeds. Allama Tabatabai believes that what is recorded in that book, or we can say in that sheet of your deeds, is not the numbers or the quantity, but the realness, or it's better to say the haqiqa, the truth of your deeds. Okay.
Very important.
Yes.
You know, again, it is very important to remember that whatever we do in this material life, is not forgettable.
Yes.
It's not perishable, actually.
Yes, yes.
Because we think that, okay, I can do this, I can do that, I'm free to do.
Yes.
Of course you're free, you can do whatever you like.
Yes.
But please remember that one body is writing down whatever you have practiced in this.
And,
you know,
and the essence of your deeds.
Yes.
And this is important, okay?
Exactly.
The essence and the innate, we can say innateness of your deeds are being recorded,
Exactly. We write down